Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the Deals podcast, where we speak to private equity and venture capital practitioners about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Satyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. We have with us today Pierre Leconte, managing director at TSG Consumer Partners, where he's responsible for origination, due diligence, transaction structuring, and working with portfolio companies. Pierre sits on the boards of several TSG platforms, including ATI Restoration and Joe Hudson's Collision Center. He's here to talk to us about the firm's investment strategy and the state of consumer M&A in 2025. Pierre, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Nikita.
Great. Well, let's get started with talking a little bit about your career and how you found yourself at TSG.
Sure, you bet. So ours is a firm that specializes in consumer and retail brands. And frankly, I've always had a personal interest in those sorts of businesses. In fact, I'm the sort of guy that nobody wants to go shopping with because I always stop in the aisles and stare at the shelves and take way too long. But I've been able to translate that into a bit of a career for myself. So I started my career consulting to those sorts of retail brands with a small boutique consultancy, and then eventually pivoted to brand management in the food industry, and then landed with Bain & Company conducting due diligence research for private equity clients before I joined TSG about 20 years ago. And in fact, four of our most tenured partners, myself included, have actually come from that Bain consulting heritage.
That's pretty great. And at TSG, obviously, I've already gone over what you do, but I'd love to hear a little bit about like what your day-to-day looks like.
Day-to-day always differs. You know, as you mentioned, I sit on the boards of six different companies, some of which are very unrelated to the other. I sit on the board of several automotive parts and services investments. I also sit on the board of a franchisor of beauty and wellness services, as well as a home services businesses and ATI that you mentioned. So sometimes I'm on calls reviewing monthly financial results. Sometimes I'm in discussions with our CEO about organizational openings that they need to fill. And other times I might be looking at an add-on acquisition that we might consider for one of our businesses. At the same time, I'm also looking at new opportunities for investments and talking to different companies in different spaces that might be completely unrelated to what's in my portfolio today. So I kind of bounce around between the new business side and an existing portfolio management on an ongoing basis.
Tell us a little bit about the firm's strategy. I want to learn more about what your checklist looks like when you're going after a platform investment, for instance.
Sure. So TSG's been around for almost 40 years, but we've had a very consistent investment thesis. We're always looking to partner with high growth, profitable consumer brands, in many cases led by the original entrepreneurs. We're not a private equity turnaround shop or value investor. We're a growth investor. So those are the sort of brands that we're most interested in and we have a long history of partnering with.
What are some of the categories that you typically invest in? Like obviously you've done, as you mentioned, a wide range of companies, restaurants, fitness, consumer goods. I'd love to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, we've invested in all those categories. We've also been deep investors in the consumer products arena, food and beverage products. We have a long history of investing in beauty care products, household and pet products we've invested in. More recently, we've gone very deep into the home services sector. We've invested in a couple of direct-to-consumer e-commerce brands as well. The common thesis all being that there's a consumer brand in there somewhere and a relationship and an emotional connection with the consumers that they serve in their particular industry. So we like to find the great opportunities no matter where they are in that consumer spectrum.
And is there an EBITDA or revenue range that you prefer to play in for platform investments?
You know, typically these are profitable companies. And so most of these companies are probably going to be north of $10 to $20 million in EBITDA. And in terms of revenue, that can range from several hundred million dollars to even over $1 billion in case one of our largest investments. But that's generally within the scale. Within that, we can write equity checks of several hundred million dollars or as small as, say, $100 million.
And you're pretty flexible with your investments as well. It's not just always control investments.
That's right. We actually do both minority and control investments. And it doesn't really matter to us. We have a long multi-decade history of actually investing in both types of situations. We partner with the management team in the same way. We bring our resources to bear in the same way. And for us, we're very comfortable sitting in a business from either perspective.
And speaking of the resources that you bring to your investments, I'd love to know a little bit more about the post-acquisition value add that the firm usually does.
Yeah, for sure. So with every investment, we really kind of go into it looking to partner with the management teams and starting with both a 100-day tactical plan, but also a multi-year strategic plan as to where we want the investment to go. We really view ourselves as a sounding board for management and a partner to work through business issues, such as when the pandemic came up over the last several years and a few of our businesses had to close a lot of retail locations and subsequently reopen those. As you can imagine, that was all hands on deck to work with that. But we also have internal resources beyond the deal team and professionals like myself that we try to bring to bear for our portfolio companies. And one of them is our internal group called TSG Vantage, which is really an internal team of specialists that work exclusively with our partner companies to create value. So these are experts in market research, finance, operation, talent management, commercialization, as well as digital and social media marketing. And they're full-time, they work with us, and they go to work for our management teams and our investments to really try to scale the revenue growth and the profitability growth of those companies, which of course makes those businesses more valuable for our investors over the long run.
And is TSG Vantage relatively new? Like, is that a new group, or was it in some shape or form, has it always existed?
I'd say it's new really over the last several years. It's something that started before the pandemic, but we've really accelerated that over the last couple of years where we brought in additional resources. It really depends upon the needs of our companies. When we first started the Vantage Group, it was really focused on being state-of-the-art in digital and social media marketing because we found that most of our companies were not cutting edge in that regard. And it was frankly hard to keep up with how fast things were changing. Some of us grew up on Facebook and others grew up on Instagram, and now people are growing up on TikTok. And it's hard to be an expert in all those things if you're an executive. So we really wanted to have a resource that could be helpful to our teams thinking through how to go to market with those various channels. And then we just kind of built on it from there, where we realized, you know, our teams needed financial reporting help. They needed talent management help. They needed to think through where they could save money from a cost management perspective and procurement. So there's a bunch of different areas that we just felt like we could buttress and really offer resources to go to work for those management teams. And that's just where we've been building the Vantage Group up over the last few years.
And the length of investment for you is something that I'm curious about as well, because you're not looking at it from a timeline perspective is the sense that I got, but I'd love to know what the average hold period is.
Yeah, that's right. We never enter an investment with a hard and fast rule about how long we can hold that investment, but you know, it typically winds up being somewhere on the spectrum of 5 to 7 years. It's been earlier than that for sure, and it's been later than that for sure, but I'd say that's about the average that we seek to invest. And we don't have any pressures about when to get liquid on an asset. We've been lucky in that regard and that we can kind of manage what's best for our investors and what's best for the company.
And speaking of some of your investments, obviously, one of the most notable ones for me is Planet Fitness. I'd love to hear more about the history there. And what was it like when you decided to partner with the brand initially, the brand itself?
Yeah, you know, so that Planet Fitness is certainly one of the brands that we're most proud of having invested in. And really, we had a decade-long partnership with the brand through two different aspects, being an investor in both the franchisor and subsequently being an investor in one of the largest franchisees called Sunshine Fitness. But we first invested in the franchisor back in 2012. And, you know, frankly, we'd been studying at the fitness space for several years. We'd been looking at the franchise space for several years. And what we loved about Planet was it had an incredible price point to the consumer, $10 a month for a membership, but a very simple operating model that was really disrupting the gym industry. So there was no group fitness, there was no personal training, no juice bars, no pools, but just lots of cardio and strength equipment that could be accessed 24 hours a day in a judgment-free zone where all were welcome to work out, no matter how new they were to the gym environment. And we found that fascinating, and we saw the growth and momentum that was happening within these gyms and how easily franchisees were able to open up these gyms with really very low labor, but also generate great unit economics for themselves. And so we thought this was truly a disruptive brand that we wanted to help scale.
And how did it grow under TSG's ownership? Like I recall you mentioning it had maybe like 500 locations when you invested in it, and now it's massive. But from investment to IPO, how did it grow?
Yeah, you know, so we spent several years partnering with the management team to really expand the team in key areas like finance, franchise operation, and marketing while creating franchisee councils to provide feedback to the franchisor. We did things like simplifying the royalty structure and accelerated other revenue streams, like re-equipping older gyms. We launched the brand into international markets like Canada and Mexico, And the end result was that we found ourselves in a position to take the company public in 2015, when we'd almost doubled the unit count and brought it public on the New York Stock Exchange, where it still trades very successfully today as a $10 billion enterprise value business with almost 20 million members across 50 states and five countries. So I think it's worked out well for
I'd agree. So did you clearly see a path to IPO from the start, or maybe midway through the investment? Or did you at some point consider, okay, we're going to go out, do a process, see who the ideal buyer is going to be for this space, and then land on an IPO?
Yeah, we thought this business would actually make a tremendous public company from the time we invested in it. Our CEO, with whom we partnered, Chris Rondeau, he had a vision that Planet Fitness delivered health to its customers and wealth to its franchisees, as he used to say. And frankly, he wanted the investing public to be able to share in our incredible success. And so taking the business public was always a vision of his, and we were able to successfully do that with him. And he ran the business for many years post-IPO. And I think it's a testament today that we have so many gyms across many different countries now. The number of gyms has over quadrupled from when we made our investment over a decade ago. And the number of members has done the same. So I think it's really a testament to his vision to making this truly a public brand.
And obviously, as you mentioned, you love the investment so much. You came back to the system as a franchisee with Sunshine. Was this in 2017?
That's right, it was. We took the business public in 2015. We successfully sold out of our public stock in the franchisor by summer 2017. And we were actually considering our next investment. And we were looking at becoming a franchisee of a large restaurant system. But then we realized that we had actually introduced private equity to the franchisee system of Planet. And we knew Planet better than anyone. And we thought it was, frankly, the best franchisor opportunity that was available. And so we actually decided to partner with Planet's very first franchisee, who was based out of Orlando, Florida, a company called Sunshine Fitness. And we made that investment in the fall of 2017.
And how did that investment grow to the stage where you finally exited back to Planet Fitness? Did you consolidate some of that franchisee base, open new stores? I would love to know more about that.
Yeah, we actually built on a base of about 30 gyms that they were operating in Florida. And then over the next 5 years, we grew that organically by opening many new gyms, as well as acquisitions of other franchisees in the Southeast, to the point where we had a base of about 114 gyms, all the while growing throughout the pandemic. And then we subsequently sold that back to Planet Fitness, the corporate franchisor, in 2022, as you mentioned.
The similar question is Planet Fitness's IPO. Was, again, that a path that you saw from the beginning that, hey, we could sell this back to the franchisor, or did you want to sell to another private equity firm? How did that decision come about?
Yeah, that one, we didn't necessarily have that playbook in mind when we made our investment in Sunshine Fitness, but we were, of course, very close to the Planet Fitness corporate team since we had worked with them for 5 years and helped guide them through the IPO process. At the time, Planet Corporate was looking to expand its ownership of its own corporate clubs division and really saw Sunshine Fitness as the perfect match, given the long tenure of our management team and the base of highly profitable gyms that we had in the Southeast that married well with the gyms that Planet Corporate owned in the Northeast. And so while we technically did run a process to sell the business, Planet Fitness stepped in and exercised its ROFR and purchased our gyms in 2022 for $800 million. And we're able to capture the management team, capture the gyms. And frankly, you know, obviously it was a win-win given our relationship with the corporate team.
That deal in many ways, I feel like, was a sign of fitness still being alive after the pandemic and people still going back to the gyms. I think that was one of the ones that we were like, okay, M&A is still happening in this space. Has fitness M&A come back from that level now to maybe pre-pandemic levels to like 2019 when M&A was really strong?
Yeah, I think you're right, Nick, that consumers really came back to the large gyms first, the boutiques, because they were smaller spaces, they were a little bit more intimate. Those took a little bit longer for people to come back. And quite frankly, many of those boutiques were disrupted by work from home and office travel patterns that changed during the pandemic. But, you know, while I wouldn't say M&A is quite back to where it was, you know, 5 or 6 years ago in the fitness industry, it certainly is robust. You've had a couple of transactions happen in the last few years. If you look at what Planet Fitness reports corporately, they are doing just fine. There are other businesses that have traded in the interim, and consumers are basically still building up their fitness patterns. But frankly, they're doing it in a different way than where they did 5 or 6 years ago. They're doing more workouts at home. They're mixing up workouts, working out at a boutique sometimes, working out off a video sometimes, working out in a regular gym like a Planet Fitness sometimes. And then also shifting a little bit more from the days of running on treadmills and pure cardio to doing a lot more strength training. So the landscape has changed, but the opportunities are still there to invest in the sector.
For sure. And speaking of current investments, very interesting space for me personally, because I love covering facility services, but ATI restoration, obviously that's a space that's become really attractive over the past few years. I'd love to know when you started looking at this industry as a place where you can make an investment.
Yeah, we actually started looking at the restoration industry and the mitigation industry a few years before the pandemic, realizing that this was typically a recession-resistant space where a consumer might have a water leak in their home, or they might have a fire in their house, and they have to deal with the mitigation efforts that are required after you go through that on an emergency basis. And quite frankly, it seems to be happening more and more if you think about some of the tailwinds of potential climate change and what's going on with the environment. You read about more hurricanes and these fires and tornadoes and such. And those are all just, you know, on a large loss basis. But on an everyday basis, people are still seeing the same things in their homes happening that have to be dealt with. And so we thought it was a very interesting sector. And we thought it would be one that we certainly wanted to invest behind from the standpoint of serving both consumers, but also businesses, because they go through the same situations that we all do in our homes.
And what drew you to ATI in particular? What year was it that you invested in the brand?
So we invested in them in 2020, right in the early days of the pandemic. In fact, we had met with the owners of the business in winter of 2020 and closed the deal remotely. So it was our first deal that we closed remotely in the summer of 2020. But it was a family-owned business run by Gary Moore and his three sons. Gary started the business in the late 1980s and had really built out a strong restoration empire across the West Coast, primarily with a little bit of presence in Texas. I think he was in 10 states at the time. And we really loved the culture of the business, the family-owned ethos, the service orientation, and the brand reputation and the platform and the ability to potentially expand it and take that brand national, which is where we focused the last several years.
And how much of that was organic? How much of that was driven by acquisitions? Because again, this is a very fragmented space.
That's right, it is. We have actually completed 18 acquisitions over the last 5 years with ATI. We've taken the business from the initial 20 offices that we had in 10 states to 70 offices today in 27 states, and to what was primarily a West Coast footprint to now a national footprint up and down the Eastern Seaboard through the Midwest, as well as the West Coast. So while we've grown organically, certainly grown our organic business, we've also been aggressive about trying to establish offices and plant resources across the country, because in many cases, some of these catastrophes occur in different parts of the country, but also just you need to be able to serve locally. You know, if I have a fire in my house in Charlotte, I need a truck to come on down from somewhere in the vicinity as opposed to come on out from the West Coast. So we've been very aggressive on the acquisition front.
Absolutely. And are you planning to continue that through 2025? Do you anticipate making more acquisitions for ATI?
We do. You know, the pace may change for us. We want to make sure we're integrating properly and bringing these businesses together and frankly, servicing a lot of the opportunities that are in front of us. You know, we're deeply involved in situations like the LA fires, unfortunately, and servicing there because our company is based in Anaheim. But in the meantime, we will be working on future acquisitions, perhaps later this year, perhaps early 26. But, you know, right now we're building on the base of what we have with our 70 offices and really leveraging that into a national provider for mitigation and restoration services for all of our customers.
That brings me to the more broad question around consumer M&A in 2025. And what it's been like for the first quarter, I don't think it's come back the way people expected in many ways. So curious to hear your thoughts about what you're seeing in the market.
Yeah, you know, I think the market is still there from an M&A perspective. We certainly have been looking very actively at several deals. It just depends upon which sectors that you find them in. M&A kind of goes in waves, and some sectors are hot for a few years and then they slow down. Other sectors kind of peak up. And we've certainly seen a few deals that we've been chasing very hard over the last few weeks. And I'm sending out an LOI today as well. So the M&A market is there. You just got to know where to look.
And where would you say is the best place to look right now within consumer? Just where do you think the best opportunities are? We talked about fitness, obviously, and facility services, but restaurants is something you mentioned too.
Yeah. You think about a lot of the uncertainty that's happening with the consumer today. You think about the situation with tariffs. Consumers are still using everyday services, and that's why we do think fitness is a sector that has tailwinds for years to come. We do think certain types of restaurants are also in that space. More everyday restaurants, your QSR, potentially your fast food restaurants continue to see growth. And industries like franchising remain very robust and healthy for consumers and for the franchisees who are looking to expand and maybe find a way to step out of the corporate rat race and run their own business. So we think those remain very interesting sectors right now, and we don't see any sign of a slowdown there.
And speaking of tariffs and potential inflation, obviously it's reshaping the consumer industry a little. And like you mentioned, where you invest in is going to be different. Do you anticipate maybe a little bit of a shift towards services over goods in the consumer industry because of that?
There certainly may be some of that. I haven't checked the news today, but there seems to be new tariffs every week that are driving different reactions in the marketplace. Certainly, inflation may be coming in certain sectors and certain goods where there are tariffs that have already been enacted, and it may be coming in other areas, such as alcohol and other areas where tariffs have been announced, but maybe not formally enacted. So we just try to find the pockets where tariffs aren't really necessarily going to play a role in consumer sales or demand. And we can still find product categories where that's true. Areas like beauty care, where it doesn't really probably drive as much of an impact as it might in auto parts or services, and then focus there. But then services remain robust, as we've just talked about, with areas like restaurants and gyms, for sure.
And speaking of sort of auto services, aftermarket services, I think collision centers was a great example that you gave the last time we talked about how that's one area that you think is going to remain really strong. Could you talk a little bit more about that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. We all know that there's been a number of tariffs that have been announced on automobiles. Auto parts come significantly from overseas, from both China and places like Mexico. So it just feels like in very short order, there's going to be some inflation in the prices of new cars as consumers go shopping for those. And so in our world, collision is driven by the ability to fix everyday cars, cars that are already on the road that need to be repaired to get back on the road. And if prices of new cars are rising, that means there's less totals for the insurance companies to simply write a check for, and they'd rather fund the repair of existing vehicles. So in our business, I think that will bode well. That is, the price ceiling for new cars continues to rise, insurers will want to get more cars fixed rather than simply totaled. And that will create more demand for our collision centers. And hopefully we'll see a benefit from that in 2025 and beyond.
Absolutely. And I know we didn't touch upon this earlier, but just Joe Hudson, again, that's a very fragmented space as well. Did you build that through a mix of organic and acquisitions? And is that going to continue?
That's right. You know, this is a chain based out of Alabama that has over 250 locations across the Southeast today, in many different states. And we built that via combination of acquisitions of mom and pop collision centers, as well as greenfield and brownfield development of new collision centers around the country. And we see that pattern continuing. Consumers are looking for a recognizable brand in that space. And then the insurers, frankly, they want to deal with fewer and fewer vendors. And it's helpful for them to have a provider that can actually service cars, whether that's in Maryland, all the way down to Florida, or out west to Texas. And that's what we can certainly do with our platform at Joe Hudson's.
Absolutely. And the IPO market, I guess, would be the one thing that I haven't touched on. Do you anticipate it maybe opening up a little bit more in the second half of the year? Or do you think we're going to maybe wait till 2026 for that?
I think it'll open up in the second half of the year. I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now, and that'll put a hold on IPOs right now, because you never want to take a company public in an uncertain market, regardless of whether or not your industry is impacted. Investors, when they're not feeling bullish, they tend not to lean into buying new equities. But I think by the back half of the year, I think we'll get a sense as to where the inflation landscape is. I think we'll get a sense as to what tariffs are happening or not. And I think people will realize there's been a statement made by the existing administration as to where the economy is going. And there'll be confidence to potentially bring great companies out to the public markets. And it's month to month in the IPO market, and I think you can never write off a year, and I certainly wouldn't write off 2025 just yet.
There's a great quote. What did I not ask you, either about TSG strategy or the consumer space in general, that you think maybe we should touch on?
Just generally, I think, you know, it's pretty interesting to see how the consumer mentality has changed over the last several years. I think the pandemic was probably the single biggest change I've seen in my career in terms of how consumers purchase, how they think about what goods and services they use, their usage occasions. We talked about that with working from home and how that's impacted certain businesses. but also just, you know, how it's impacted their desire to get out and have more experiences like dining out and going to restaurants. You know, to me, that's been fascinating to see. And we're still seeing the ripple effects of that flow through in many of our companies today. And you couple that with what's happening in the new administration and some of the regulatory actions that are happening there. It's creating a pretty unique environment where we have to be pretty adept to find the right opportunities to grow and scale. But it's certainly something we're focused on. We have plenty of dry powder and we're excited to continue doing that here and find the right disruptive consumer and retail brands for our investors.
Yeah, never a dull day.
No, that's for sure.
Well, thank you so much for a great conversation, Pierre. I really appreciate you joining us.
You bet, Nikita. Thank you so much for the time as well.
This is Nikita Sitharaju, Senior Reporter at The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyout.